Okay, Psalm 34 now. Recalling how Yahweh responded to his cry of distress, the psalmist is encouraging others to follow his example by placing their trust in Yahweh, who is, as he says in verse 18, near to those whose hearts are broken and saves those whose spirit is crushed. So if your heart's broken, and it probably is, and your spirit is a bit crushed, and it may be, then this psalm is for you, for me. It's important, says the psalmist, that they stop doing evil and do good. And as you can tell, it's what they call an acrostic psalm, a psalm that is alphabetical, and each two lines begin with the same word of the alphabet working its way through from Aleph to Tau. And most of it, I think, speaks for itself, so let me begin with you. Verse 1. I will bless Yahweh at all times, his praise continually on my lips. With praise, my whole being glories in Yahweh. Let the lowly hear and be glad. The lowly are those who are not high up, but low down. The ordinary people, anyone can be there if you want to be humble enough. So it's just ordinary people who are struggling. Well, let them hear and be glad. Sing of Yahweh's greatness with me, and together let us exalt his name. And he says, why? I sought out Yahweh, and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. Wouldn't you like that? He delivered me from all my fears. Look to him, says the author, and be radiant. You'll never have to hide your face in shame. Naturally, we read that as Christians and we think of the face of Jesus. Of course, he who sees me sees the Father, said Jesus at the Last Supper. So here's the book of Revelations, the most powerful portrait of the risen Christ in the New Testament is in the book of Revelations, in that first part of chapter 1. And it's a long description, but it includes this, talking about the risen Christ. Of course, it's a symbolic, it's not a visual image, it's not a visual vision, it's an intellectual vision. It's a highly wrought, intelligent statement that you have to read very symbolically, which of course most visions have to be. Joan of Arc is a saint, declared by the Church a saint. Very unusual, but you can be unusual and be a saint. You can be neurotic and be a saint. You can be anything and be a saint. You know, you have to deal with who we are. Sanctity is not about being healthy, except deeply. So whatever your temperament and whatever my condition, everyone is called to sanctity. So, I don't know, I'm not saying Joan of Arc was neurotic, but she was quite unusual psychologically, you'd have to say. And she had visions, and one of the people talking to Joan of Arc was Catherine of Egypt. There was no Catherine of Egypt. So who was talking to Joan of Arc? Anybody's guess. And that's what happens in visions. See, it's only in the Second Vatican Council period they went right back over the story of Catherine of Egypt, one of the most famous saints of the medieval period that everybody... St. Catherine's... You've heard of St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai? That's after Catherine of Egypt. And the story of Catherine of Egypt is wonderful. She was in the high ranks of the nobility of Egypt. She was converted to Christianity. She was a philosopher. So I think all the women's libbers of the Middle Ages looked to her and said, yeah, you know, go for it, woman, and good on her. And the emperor, who's unnamed and of course didn't exist, but that, don't worry about the history of it, it's a wonderful story. He got 100 philosophers to come to talk to Catherine of Egypt to convince her that Christianity was rubbish. She converted them all. They all got baptized. So they had to be killed, martyred. And then finally, when he tried to seduce her, and she wasn't having any of that. The emperors might think they're pretty good, but she could see through all that stuff. So finally they murdered her on what's called a Catherine wheel. Hence the name. With all the spikes in it. I impaled her on one of these. Anyhow, sorry to tell you the story of Catherine of Egypt. But in the Second Vatican Council, when they look back, historically, there was no evidence that this woman ever existed. In other words, it was a wonderful story. And what matters is the story, what it said about values and all that. So it was like a parable, but they couldn't prove she existed anyhow, and there's no evidence for her existence, so they had to take her. To be a saint, you have to be real. So they took her out of the saints thing. Why did I say all that? I don't know. Except that Joan of Arc was spoken to by Catherine of Egypt. So what that alerts me to, and must alert you to, is the simple truth that private revelations, we never have to believe them, by the way. They're always, if you like it, go for it. If you don't worry about it. Nothing to do. They're reminders of something much more profound. But in a private revelation, the person having the revelation, the person having the vision, and the person hearing the words, of course, they're all the person's own words. So if you think there's a Catherine of Siena, and you're attracted to Catherine of Siena, and you hear this voice, you attach it to Catherine of Siena. It doesn't mean there's no truth in it, but it means we project. We all do. We hear things the way we are, not the way they are. So it reminds us to be very careful of when reading the visionaries, for example, any visionary. They might have been quite holy people, but it doesn't mean what they saw is factual. I hope you do see that. It's terribly important because many people go right off on a limb thinking, well, Mary said this and God said this and Jesus said this. No. The person who may have had a genuine religious experience, and sometimes the church says, no, it was genuine. Sometimes it says it's phony. Sometimes we don't know. But let's assume it was a genuine religious experience of a very holy person. Everything they think they hear is still part of their psyche. And they may be coming out of quite a neurotic place. So we have to say, well, thank you, that's lovely. And if it reminds you of the gospel, go back to the gospel. If it doesn't remind you of the gospel, have a cup of tea and get on with your life. Well, here's John's vision. His eyes were like the flame of fire. His face like the sun shining with full force. And that doesn't mean that the risen Christ looks like the sun, you know. But you can hear what it says, I hope. But this is very beautiful. 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18, and chapter 4, verse 6, is Paul talking about Jesus now. First of all, he's talked about Moses going up to Mount Sinai and coming down, having to veil his face because the brightness was too much. And he says, no, we don't have to do that. All of us with unveiled faces, don't hide it, unveiled. We see the glory of the Lord, the glory of God, Yahweh, the Lord, as though reflected in a mirror. We're looking at Jesus. And when we see his face, it's like a mirror reflection of God. And as we look at his face, we're being transformed into the same image. Listen to beautiful music, you become beautiful. Listen to rubbish music and you become rubbish inside. You know, we know that. And that's what we worry often about our kids too. But then again, you go back to the songs I learned when I was a kid. Innocent, stupid songs that said nothing about anything. You know, Bing Crosby or whatever. When you look at the words, they're so vacuous. I think Simon and Garfunkel are 100 times better, and so are the Beatles. But anyhow, whatever I think doesn't matter. But what you fill yourself with is what you get, isn't it? So we've got to be so protective of our young, if we can be. So they don't let all these images into their little heads. They learn to close their eyes when it's a garden inside. Why allow all these stomping bulls to come in and trample down the very lovely garden that you've built? Anyhow, we're being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. And this comes from the Lord, the Spirit. The gift of the Spirit, who is also the Lord God. For it is God who said, let light shine out of darkness. And it's this God who has shone in our hearts to give them light of the knowledge of the glory of God. Here it is, in the face of Jesus. A beautiful passage, I think. Just one of the loveliest passages of St. Paul. But it all takes us back to our psalm, which says, look at him and be radiant. Well, that's you see God reflected in nature and history, but aren't we fortunate? Mary of Magdala could look at the face of Jesus and be radiant, and so could the thief on the cross, and so could the leper, and so could the beloved disciple. They saw his face. And we have to see his face in each other, because he lives in us. We don't have to veil. We're not supposed to veil our faces. For those of you who know the Hebrew alphabet perfectly, you'll notice that the letter Vav is actually missing. You picked that up, yes. Well, so it means, it's clear that in the transmission of the text, it may have been at the bottom of a page, you know, and then, you know, how paper goes, and they lost that bit of the stuff because it got worn out or something, so we've lost something out of the psalm, it's obvious. But what we've got is good, so let's go on to Zayin, the Z word. This poor person cried, that's the psalmist, and Yahweh heard him and saved him from every danger. The angel of Yahweh encamps around those who fear him. We've had that a few times. Those who are in awe of God, aware of the sacred, live their life in the presence of the mystery. Well, the angel of Yahweh encamps around them and protects them. We need to know something about the expression, the angel of Yahweh. In the Bible itself, forget the very late Greek Septuagint writings, in the Bible, the angel of Yahweh is not a spiritual creature separate from God. The angel of Yahweh is always Yahweh, but they knew that Yahweh is transcendent. So the angel of God was ways in which God showed God's presence in ways we can access. Do you get it? It's the imminent presence of the transcendent deity, because obviously they knew you can't actually see God, but God can reveal God's presence in different ways. And the revelation of God's presence in our life is called the angel, the messenger. God as messenger, not God as God. God's presence mediated through the angel. That says nothing about angels or devils. That was a much later concept in Judaism. It only came into late Judaism. Of course, it's all through the New Testament, because that's the world they lived in. And had the New Testament been written in Ireland, and it could have been if Mary had been Irish, you know, I don't know how many people were asked to be the mother of the Messiah and said no. Anyhow, Mary said yes, and she was a Jew, so that's what happened. But it could have been Irish. Don't laugh all your little jokes there. But had it been in Ireland, well, the gospel stories would have been full of leprechauns. Of course they would have. Because I don't mean that really seriously. It's cultural. Language is cultural. How do you give expression to the mystery that's transcendent except in the music and language and poetry and art of your culture? That's what you've got to do. Don't realize everything. Remember the limits of language, and also remember what it's pointing to, and let the language carry you into the mystery. Don't lock yourself into the minutiae of human limited language. Some people do that and they end up in quite a mess, or they inflict it on others and make them into a mess. So back to my thing. The angel of Yahweh encamps around those who fear him and protects them. That's verse 7. And look at where that comes from. Exodus chapter 14, verse 9. The angel of God who was going before the Israelite army, this is the crossing of the Red Sea, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from in front of them and took its place behind them. So they're being led through the desert across the Red Sea by pillar of cloud by day, and at night it lit up, and the angel of Yahweh was walking before them. And as soon as they got across the Red Sea, it switched place, and now the angel of Yahweh got behind them and the pillar of cloud, and the Egyptians couldn't see where they were. They got all confused, and you know the whole story of it's a wonderful way of talking about the angel of Yahweh encamps around those of whom God is surrounding us with love, protecting us. So, verse 8, taste and see that Yahweh is good. Happy are you who take refuge in him. You won't be surprised to know that that verse is often used in our liturgy because it directly relates us to the Eucharist. Taste and see that Yahweh is good. And that's what's beautiful about, not only, but that's what's beautiful about Catholic Christianity. It really is. Taste is important. Touch is important. Eyes are important. You know, sacraments. It's a very sacramental faith. It's not simply intellectual, though it's a highly intellectual thing. Many converts have become Catholic through intellectual demand, and I could run through 20 of them in England. You'd all know all their names, including Cardinal Newman and Hopkins and Ronald Knox, and so it goes on, and Chesterton. I mean, these people were driven into the church by intellectual demand. So it's a highly structured and sensible faith. But it's all about the body, isn't it? It's all about water and candles and bells, and you've got to have all of this because our bodies need to be involved. It's very incarnational, as Christianity should be. The Word was made flesh. So it's touch is important and everything is. Smell is important, sight is important, hearing is important. Well, taste and see that the Yahweh. God can come to us in spiritual communion, of course. God does. What a wonderful thing it is to put something like bread into your mouth and wine and feel the wine go down through you into yourself a little bit of it. Don't sit too little a bit, but let it come in, and that's all part of it, surely. Well, here's St. Peter, first letter, chapter 2. Like newborn infants, long for the pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow into salvation, if indeed you have tasted that Yahweh is good. He's quoting the psalm. And spiritual milk doesn't mean non-material milk. Don't get that idea. Matter is spiritual in the New Testament sense. Everything is spiritual, which has the Spirit of God in it. The body is spiritual. So it's not spirit as distinct from matter. It's spirit as distinct from lack of spirit. Everything inspirited by God. So here's Hebrews chapter 6, verse 4. It's impossible to restore again to repentance those who've once been enlightened, have tasted the heavenly gift, and have shared in the Holy Spirit. And I hope you can see the three sacraments of initiation in that verse. They're all there. Enlightenment was the earliest word for baptism. And it still is the word used in the Greek church. Enlightened means baptized. Tasted the heavenly gift is communion, and shared in the Holy Spirit is confirmation. However one understands it, right from the middle of the first century, these were three ways of envisaging, realizing, and entry into the communion of the church. Verse 9, fear Yahweh, you his holy ones, for those who fear him lack nothing. God alone suffices, says Teresa of Avila. Those who fear him, those who are... I'm sorry if I keep saying it to you, but the trouble is that the word feared could mean afraid of God for us. We've got to be terribly careful. Fear is there, but it's fear of losing God, and it's awe at the wonder of God, and it's a recognition of our smallness. It's not a tiny, scared thing. It's much richer than that. His holy ones reminds me of Exodus chapter 19, 6, which says, you shall be a priestly kingdom, a holy nation. And I know you know that Vatican II wasn't the first time, but it renewed our kind of energetic awareness that everyone is called to holiness. Because something had crept into the psyche of ordinary people in our Catholic Church anyhow. I think, you may not agree with this, but I think there was a bit of a thing that, you know, religious, even using the word religious for those who took three vows of poverty, chastity and obedience, is an indication of a warping of imagination, you see. Because why is someone with a vow of poverty, chastity, obedience, why call them religious? Isn't a mother religious? Isn't a father religious? Isn't a, you know what I mean? Religious is such a general word. So we made a bit of a problem, but it wasn't just a problem of vocabulary, it was a problem of psyche. So people thought, oh, ring up the Carmelites and ask them to pray. And of course ring up the Carmelites and ask them to pray, because they're great prayers. But the Vatican Council remind us that everyone is called to a life of holiness. Everyone. Well, we knew that. I'm sure Mum knew it and Dad knew it. But we have to keep saying it, because otherwise they think, oh, Father will do it. Or people give me money sometimes to say a mass for people who are dying, and I understand where that comes from. If they don't, I'm very happy. If they do, I don't want to be rude. But sometimes I give them money and say, would you pray for me? Would you, I'll give you $5 too, and would you pray for my mother too? And then I get all confused. But I want to confuse them. You know, I want them to know that they're praying for my mother and my prayer. It's just whatever. And if I've confused you, I'm not sorry. Because what we're talking about here is something very important that us, we, you, ordinary people, know that you're called for holiness, and the Vatican Council defines it beautifully. It's all are called to the life of holiness according to his or her state of life, and it is tending to the perfection of love. That's a very beautiful definition of holiness. It's not being perfect, because we're on a journey, but it is tending to the perfection of love. So if you're tending to the perfection of love as a grandparent, that's what holiness is. Go for it. We need it. If you're tending to the perfection of love as a teacher or as a single woman or a single man in work or as a priest or whatever. But that's what it's all about. So we're a holy nation, a nation committed to tend to the perfection of love. Here's Leviticus 22. You shall not profane my holy name, that I may be acknowledged as holy among the people of Israel. For I am Yahweh. I make you holy. I who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God, for I am Yahweh. And Leviticus 26:11. I will place my dwelling in your midst, and I will walk among you. I'll be your God. You'll be my people. And we beautifully express that in the tabernacle in the church. And it was a lovely thing we were trained to do as children. You've got to keep training the children to do it. We don't want these things to stop. We used to go in on our way to school and make a little visit to the Blessed Sacrament, and you see the little lamp there and you know that Jesus is present there. That doesn't mean he's not present everywhere else, in your heart and the hearts of the people. But don't we need these reminders? Don't we need these little acts? And we need to train children in them so that they become aware that something very special is in this place. The tabernacle is a sacramental reminder of Jesus walking through life with us. And we need these reminders. Otherwise we get distracted and gone. Verse 10. The rich and the powerful. If you look up New Revised Standard Version, they'll put young lions there, and I don't want to say they're wrong, but scholars that I appreciate see the word for young lions is kupirim. The word for the rich and powerful is kubirim. It's just one letter difference. So it's likely, I suggest to you, that there's been a scribal error. And so rather than saying young lions suffer want and hunger, which makes sense, I think the text was intended to say the rich and the powerful, the kubirim, suffer want and hunger, but the person who seeks after Yahweh lacks nothing good. Come, O children, listen to me. I'll teach you the fear of Yahweh. I'll teach you to be awestruck at the wonderful presence of the sacred in your life and in your history. Deuteronomy 31:12. Assemble the people, men and women and children, as well as the aliens residing in your towns, so that they may hear and learn to fear Yahweh, your God, and to observe diligently all the words of this law, and so that their children who have not known it may hear and learn to fear Yahweh your God as long as you live in the land that you are crossing over the Jordan to possess. Verse 12, which is the letter M in the alphabet. Are you one who desires life and wants a long and prosperous life? Well then, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Stop doing evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. The eyes of Yahweh are on the just. His ears are open to their cry. The face of Yahweh confronts evildoers to cut off all memory of them from the earth. And that whole text, except for the last line there, is quoted by St. Peter in the New Testament, in the first letter, chapter 3. Well, he introduces it with these words. Have unity of spirit, he says to the community. Sympathy, love for one another, a tender heart and a humble mind. It's nice to hear St. Peter using such words because he learnt them from Jesus. So, have unity of spirit, sympathy, love for one another, a tender heart, a humble mind. Don't repay evil for evil or abuse for abuse. On the contrary, repay with a blessing. It is for this that you were called, that you might inherit a blessing. That's chapter 3, verse 8 to 9, and in verse 10 he goes on and quotes the verses we've just read. So St. Peter read it and played it. It's nice to know we're doing it. Are you the one who desires life, etc.? And he goes on, this is back to the Psalm, verse 17. When you cry out for help, Yahweh hears and rescues you from every danger. Yahweh is near to those whose hearts are broken. He comes to the help of those whose spirits are crushed. And the famous psalm, the Miserere, the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit, a broken, contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. Verse 19, many are the afflictions of the just, but Yahweh rescues them from them all. And the next verse is quite significant in the tradition of the Bible, so I'll need to spend a few moments explaining it. Verse 20, which is the second last letter of the alphabet, Yahweh keeps guard over all their bones, not one of them will be broken. So that's Psalm 34, verse 20. So, bones. You can visualize it easily, symbolically. The people are experiencing suffering, but their bones will not be broken. Your bones are the things that in a thousand years' time will still be there. The rest of us is flesh and brokenness, etc. But your bone is your substantial self. Not even death stops the bone, you see? So that's their image for you at your most enduring. So the nation is suffering, but God is looking after the bones of the nation. It will not be broken. It's almost exactly what Jesus said. The gates of hell will not prevail against the church, you know. I will be with you all days, even to the end of time. That kind of promise. Now, this truth that's expressed in the psalm, that the bones will not be broken, is used symbolically in the ritual of the Passover, which could be quite a late ritual, by the way. Don't forget, when you read the story of in the book of Exodus of the Passover, you might think they celebrated the Passover back in the 13th century BC. That would be a wrong thinking. That's prehistory. And the stories about it are legend. Handed down, some of them, not saying legend. Well, all legend, I suppose, is based on something. So, but they don't give you the history. The language of the book of Exodus is all liturgical language, church language, temple language. So what they're talking about is the ritual which they enact at the time, which celebrated an ancient memory of the crossing of the Red Sea. So they put that language into the event as symbolically manifested, not described historically. So when in the Passover ceremony, in which no bone of the lamb was broken. And why didn't they break the bones of the lamb? The firstborn lamb, it was a year old, it was perfect, and they were celebrating it in order so that the next crop of lambs would be beautiful. So they picked the best one from there, a symbol of themselves as God's chosen people, God the shepherd, looking after his sheep. We are his sheep, the flock of the sheep of his flock. So when they celebrate this, the lamb is a symbol of Israel. The lamb is a symbol of the Jewish people. The lamb is a symbol of us who were little and small, but God chose us as his own. So when the lamb was killed and then shared out, not one of its bones, there it is, Exodus 12:46, you shall not break any of its bones. In other words, no one can break Israel. No one can destroy God's chosen people. And then, isn't it right then, Paul starts calling Christianity the new Israel, the Israel of God, the Israel of Christ. So the renewed Israel. John draws attention to this as he depicts Jesus on the cross. So he's picking up both Exodus 12, the ritual statement, and the Psalm. Psalm 34, verse 20. And he says, these things, Jesus, remember they broke the bones of the first and the other and they pierced Jesus' heart, side with a spear, because he was already dead, which says a fair bit about the scourging at the pillar and many other things. He was nearly dead before they crucified him. They so badly treated him. Well, these things occurred so that Scripture might be fulfilled, not one of his bones will be broken. And John's point is not, it didn't happen to break his legs, because the breaking of the legs was, of course, so that you couldn't push up and resist. If your whole weight sagged, well, your lungs would collapse and you couldn't breathe and you'd die very quickly. Whereas we have this tendency to want to prolong life. So the pushing it with the legs was no good and sagging of the body. Well, the death would come. Well, they didn't break Jesus' legs because he was already dead, and they proved that by their spear. Well, but John's not interested in that little bit of information. He's interested in the fact that this became for him a symbol that Jesus is the Paschal Lamb, do you get it? He is the chosen one of God, that his reign will last forever, and so on. Physical death cannot destroy Jesus' life. And the psalm concludes, and I conclude, evil brings death to the wicked. Those who hate the just will be condemned. Yahweh redeems the life of his servants. No one who takes refuge in him will be rejected.